Okay. So I am joined today by Chelsea Reinhardt. So Chelsea works with Better Cotton. She's Director of Standard and Assurance. As Director of Standard Assurance at Better Cotton, Chelsea oversees the development and the better of the Better Cotton farm level standards. She also oversees the assurance and verification system that ensures all licensed Better Cotton farmers comply with the standard. Prior to Better Cotton, Chelsea was Deputy Director of Standards at Global Reporting Initiative. And before that, she led the supply chain assurance team for the Marine Stewardship Council. I'm also joined by Stefan Horman. Stefan works is Chief Operation Officers at Fair Rubber. He's the Executive Director of the Environmental Foundation for Global Na for the Global Nature Fund and COO of the Fair Rubber Association, which he joined in 2021. He was initiated. He has initiated and coordinated various multi-stakeholder initiatives, such as the European Business and Biodiversity Campaign and the Food for Biodiversity Association. He is currently in charge of the Fair Rubber Association, which has over 30 members, and is in and the focus is the fair trade of natural rubber. This includes NGOs and companies who are using fairly produced rubber in their products, including footwear, elastic bands, bicycle tires, and condoms. Stefan holds a master in political and administrative science. He's based in Bonn, Germany. Just a little quick introduction on the kind of projects we've worked at XEPA to sort of connect the dots of why we're hosting this session and what brings us to the OECD Garment and Footwear Forum. So smallholders account for 99% of the world's cotton production across 70 countries and 85% of the global production of natural rubber. Yet cotton and natural rubber are critical raw materials for the garment industry. Cotton is a primary fabric. Natural rubber is essential for the components like elastic bands and garments. However, fragmented smallholder agricultural commodity production presents several challenges. Firstly, the small-scale individual farms are often lead to inefficient production practices and limited access to modern technologies. Smallholders may lack resources, mechanizations, irrigation, and quality input, affecting overall productivity and yield consistency. Secondly, the fragmentation of land and operation makes it difficult to achieve economies of scale. This limits bargaining powers in the market, making it challenging for smallholders to negotiate fair price for their produce. Additionally, it hampers collective action, hindering the adoption of sustainable practices and certifications that are becoming increasingly important in the global markets. Furthermore, inadequacy of infrastructure, including roads, storage facilities, and market linkages, can lead to post-harvest losses and difficulty in reaching distant markets. Smallholders often face financial constraints, limited access to credit, and lack of knowledge in financial management, making it challenging to invest in their farms and improve their productivity. Lastly, climate change has exacerbated these challenges, causing unpredictable weather patterns and extreme events that can devastate crops. Smallholders struggle to adapt, to changing conditions due to the limited resources and lack of technical expertise. Addressing these issues require comprehensive policies and policies that support smallholders through training and access to finance, improved infrastructure and market linkages to enhance their resilience and productivity in the sector. Which leads us to our discussion today. So at XEPA, we have to address these challenges, we have worked on several projects, including this program called the Cascade Program, where We work with smallholder farmers in the rubber supply chain to enhance and build their capacity. We work with local buyers of and rubber smallholders farmers. We work with NGOs on the ground, and so we work with various public and private partners through our SUTI initiative. Particularly in Indonesia and Sri Lanka, to address several issues. So first, it's to build a core group of 2 to 3 players as a stepping stone. Around this core group, we structure coalitions around the public players, funders, international and local players. We try to deliver clarity on the key goals and transparency that underpin the methodologies to build trust between the players. We strive to also balance out the operational solutions with the local expectations. So as such, what we're trying to do is really I mean, this will be discussed further with Chelsea and Stefan, but it's about having fair cotton and fair rubber. But ultimately, it's about improving the livelihoods of the farmers. So it's a good segue for me to pass on the discussion to Chelsea and maybe respond to our first question as to why rubber and the cotton supply chain are so fragmented. And as a result of this fragmentation, what are the on-the-ground challenges and limitations for farmers? Thank you.
Thank you, Christelle. Hi, everyone. Nice to be with you this morning. So my name is Chelsea Reinhardt from Better Cotton. First, I want to just talk a few minutes about the cotton production sector and what makes it unique amongst other commodities. So as Christelle mentioned, more than 90% of cotton producers remain today smallholder family farmers. And this is quite unique amongst other agricultural commodities and production sectors. And it means that more than 3/4 of the world's cotton is still being produced by farmers and family farmers who are working on just a few hectares of land and who are really growing crops at a largely subsistence level. So most farmers, cotton farmers are not only cotton farmers, they're growing a variety of crops, food crops, local import crops, domestic crops, but cotton remains an important cash crop for many of them. And many of our farmers, many better cotton farmers, many cotton farmers in the world today are still living around the poverty line. And so if you're a big retailer or a brand that sources a lot of cotton, chances are in your supply chains, the majority of your cotton is still coming from small family farms. A few years ago, we did some direct outreach and field-based research with cotton farmers in India. And one of the things that we learned is that the majority of cotton farmers were actually looking to do less farming in the future. And they really wanted to see their children's generation move out of cotton farming to the degree possible. And what we heard from them is that the benefits that they've achieved of having better access to training and capacity strengthening and information in order to grow a more sustainable and healthy crop, that they saw those benefits were already being undermined by changes in climatic conditions and pest pressure. And 87% of those farmers were already feeling day to day the effects of climate change on their crops and on their production. And that just makes the work even harder because the benefits that we're achieving are working against basically the trends in the industry. So, next slide, please. Better Cotton was formed more than a decade ago. Our mission is really around supporting cotton farmers, their families, and their communities to survive and thrive. The way that we do that is through engagement with the entire sector. So mobilizing the value chain and the market side to create a demand for more sustainable cotton and to create a pull through the supply chain and also to create a unique funding mechanism that allows the market side of the sector to actually channel money and investment back to support field-based programs that give farmers access to more information, and support the adoption of more sustainable production practices and better labor practices at farm level. We now work in more than 15 countries around the world. The majority of our farmers remain smallholder farmers, but we do run programs either directly or through benchmark partners in some of the large farm mechanized countries, including the US, Australia, and Brazil. And in the 2021-22 harvest season, we had over 2 million Better Cotton licensed farmers. So that means they were verified as meeting our farm level principles and criteria, which is our sustainability standard, covering good agronomic practices, efficient irrigation, careful use of integrated pest management and reduction of pesticides, as well as good labor practices and decent work practices at farm level. And altogether, that was more than a fifth of the world's cotton production that was licensed as Better Cotton. Next slide, Crystal. And in terms of really trying to work on a multi-stakeholder platform, as I mentioned before, we do work with the market side to create funding back to support the farm level side. So when brands and retailers source Better Cotton, they pay a small volume-based fee off the amount of cotton that's being sourced to meet their sustainability commitments or targets. And that money goes into a dedicated fund that's managed by Better Cotton, and it goes back to pay for field level programs around farmer training, demonstration plots, access to improved inputs and farming activities. In addition, we are fundamentally a membership organization. So although we run a sustainability standard and assurance program, we are built as a membership organization, and even our board level governance is actually elected out of that membership. And that means that the priorities of Better Cotton as an organization, the standards we set, and the programs that we run are really dictated by the needs and the priorities of the cotton sector as represented across the value chain from producer organizations to traders, all the way through to brands and retailers at the other end of the chain. And here are just a few examples of country-level programs. New country startup engagement with governments and civil societies in various countries where we are working. And with that, I'll hand it back over to you, Christelle, and I think we'll come back to the other questions later in the presentation.
Thank you very much, Chelsea. Stefan, if you can also address the same question from the rubber end.
Thank you. Sorry, thanks. Yeah, I'll do a brief introduction to the Fair Rubber Association, so we can go to the next slide. As Crystal already mentioned, so we have a strong focus as Fair Rubber Association on the primary producers, which means in the field of natural rubber, it's the tappers and smallholders. We try to improve the working living conditions, and as we are a standard as well, we also try to promote environmentally friendly production of rubber. When you go to the next slide, you see that there at the moment around 35 commercial and non-commercial members in the Fair Rubber Association, which have a great variety. We have the top-selling condom brand Durex, as well as smaller companies such as footwear companies, flip-flop producers such as Slippers, for example. In total, about four companies from the garment and footwear sector, so there's room for more. And furthermore, there are processors, traders, rubber trade organizations, members. This is the commercial part. And then we have also the non-commercial part, which in the end are NGOs from the field of the environment, as well as social and human rights, and even some individuals with a scientific background, for example, are the members. And this blend of members helps us to ensure the legitimate interests of commercial members, as well, of course, as guarding for social and environmental issues and promoting fair and sustainable rubber trade in the end. So when we go now to the question about the fragmentation, so the next slide, please. This is even the graphic is even, let's say, simplified. But as you know from other commodities, It's a long value chain and sometimes not very clear about transparency and traceability, which is a challenge in particularly for the companies which might have to trace back for regulatory reasons or just for their own CSR commitments. And you look at the rubber supply chain at the beginning, there is the tapper and the smallholders. These people, about 6 million of them, get up early in the morning, usually at 3 a.m., starting to tap the trees. Then they collect the latex, they bring it to a collection station where there's a trader, a collector, a dealer, and these guys then will sell it to the companies which are processing and manufacturing the rubber. And in the end, you have a variety of products. Still, the about more than 70% of the natural rubber goes into the automotive industry, tires and non-tire automotive parts. But we have, of course, also other industries such as textiles and footwear sectors where we have shoe soles, expandable clothing, elastic ribbons, belts, and so on. And apart from that, of course, there are some challenges involved in that rubber supply chain, which means that it's a diverse geographical location of tapping, processing, and production. There's varying levels of technological and infrastructural developments across the regions, in particular, infrastructure, roads, and so on are a challenge as well. And of course, there's a lot of stakeholders somehow in that rubber orbit, starting from in some cases, unions and cooperatives, up to research institutes, which might help also the farmers to become more sustainable and support them. So, when we go to the next slide about the fragmentation and the impacts on the ground, I would like briefly to stress some challenges which we face. So, as I mentioned, storage and transport, for example, is a challenge. And the smallholders who have no access to storage facilities, for example, they have to sell the rubber in more or less in the morning very often where they tap it and they get the price on that day which is available. If they would be able and s to store it, they could probably wait for another day, get a better price, might not be an option. I have also, but on the other hand, I have to say there are some regions where there are already some informal or community organizations where the rubbers join forces and they store rubber and they auction it to bidders. So to a certain extent, there might already be some improvements in place. The other challenge we face are quality standards and in the end then also quantity standards. If you take, for example, Indonesia on the plantation level, there will be about 1 ton of dry rubber per hectare per year, while smallholders on the same site would probably only have a productivity of two-thirds, so one-third less. So their smallholders definitely could improve the productivity. Another challenge is access to credits and financial services. Quite a number of farmers and tappers might not even have a bank account. At the moment, we have a project in place in Indonesia where we try to get for 2,000 tappers for the first time in their life, even a bank account where they then can get, for example, our fair trade premium. And finally, access to market information and pricing. We asked about 1,000 farmers in Thailand what they would need when we would provide an app to them. And they clearly stated we would like to have on that app information about prices and market prices. And that was the priority and other information, such as information about sustainable farming practices, for example, are considered important, but they say it should be in combination with this very essential information, which they need to have in the end a better bargaining power against the dealers. So that's it for the moment, Crystal. I hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Stefan. I guess there's a few things to unpack in all of the points you've mentioned, both you and Chelsea. But maybe we can face. I mean, we presented sort of the challenges that are faced by by farmers and smallholders, and it would be important to note, which is really the topic of the session, to see why then we need multi-stakeholder coalitions to address these challenges. Why? I mean, clearly for the companies and the finance, and then like why do we need this multi-stakeholder initiative and coordination to address these challenges? Maybe you, Stefan, and then back to you, Chelsea.
Right, yeah, if you turn to the next slide, I mean, there are various roles of multi-stakeholder coalitions, and one could be, not necessarily every multi-stakeholder initiative might have that, is a standardization approach. And so, as Chelsea mentioned, we as Fair Harbor Association have our standard as well, covering social and environmental governance issues, and applying at the moment to several thousand farmers, tappers in various countries in Asia. And what in my understanding is core still, I mean, we can request and in the end, to a certain extent, definitely support smallholders in sustainable practices and so on. It needs to be underpinned by a fair price. Otherwise, it will only work to a limited extent. And if you go to the next slide, the Fair Harbor Association, for example, asks its company members to pay about a 50 cent euro per kilo of dry rubber on top of the market price. That, depending on the world market price on the region, that could actually top on the income of a farmer up to double the income. But in the end, we leave it up to the smallholders to decide how to use the premium. So some use it for community projects, everybody benefiting. Some use it as a top-on. So in that role, we are not interfering. So that's left more or less to the smallholders and the tappers in the region, who usually know much better what is needed in there. And then the other. If we go to the next, some products which, for example, you could get, and the brands usually pay then that fair trade premium. If you go to the next slide, key role of multi-stakeholder initiatives should be to coordinate and promote the collaboration. And in that respect, I think key is building trust, because we have to be aware that very often, let's say, a company representative in Europe or the US might have no insight in what's going on the ground when there's, for example, the tapping of the natural rubber, and the multi-stakeholder coalitions can bring these various stakeholders together. So the photo which you see, for example, these are tappers in Indonesia. And they told us for the first time in their life that they got a visit from a buyer in Europe. So we have here buyers, dealers all together showing their commitment, trying to improve for the future the value chain in the end. So this understanding and trust building is core of any multi-stakeholder initiatives which you might need. And then when we go to the next slide, the multi-stakeholder initiatives play an important role, and that's why we need them in sharing information and also in promoting tools which might be needed across various regions for an entire sector. And in the rubber sector at the moment, the core driver for this sharing information is the EU regulation on deforestation-free supply chain. Because companies importing rubber to Europe are requested to prove that the rubber does not come from deforested area. And that is a challenge to trace back at the farm level, to get geolocation data and proof of land legality. And in order to do so, for example, in our case, a standard can, of course, and the multi-stakeholder initiative can, of course, provide access to the farmers. We know where the farmers are. We might not have all the geolocation data, and we might not have the system in place which the EU requests, but it's a good start. And that's one of the key drivers also for companies also to get engaged. What we need to state here as well is that, for example, in that regulation, the EU has set quite a challenge to smallholders, because for companies it might be much easier to get all this data from one big plantation. We have also plantations in the rubber farming. Instead of asking about, let's say, 3,000 farmers about the data. So there is a risk when you set up this type of regulations. And here, definitely, the exchange between smallholder groups, buyers, and the regulators is very important to find solutions that, in the end, smallholders might not drop out of the supply chain. And then my final slide, which Chelsea mentioned as well, is capacity building and training, which can be done much better if we have various stakeholders involved. Chelsea mentioned the challenge of climate change in the cotton sector. We face a similar problem in the rubber sector, and that's this leaf which you see on the slide. It's a fungus. And that fungus is causing at the moment quite some trouble, because it has spread over the past years and reduced the latex yield about 20 to 30% in almost all growing regions. And the reason is, on the one hand, the wet weather, which is might most likely be related to climate change, and there's very other reasons, like also the rubber tree monocultures. So what we are doing here, with the support also of our members, is to promote smallholder rubber agroforestry systems, where you also plant other species and varieties to make the entire plantation of the smallholders more robust against these diseases and to avoid the infections. And a smallholder would not be able to do it by themselves. So we need, on the one hand, the financial support by the companies, but we need also very much research institutes and rubber associations to come up with solutions, as that is not an easy task to do, in particular when you consider that a rubber tree needs 7 years to grow before you can tap for the first time, and then it will be tapped of about 30 years. So that's, you cannot shift an entire system with a year. It takes a long-term approach, and whatever you plant now more or less has to be robust for the next 40 years. So these are challenges which we are facing, which we are trying to solve with capacity building, training, and research. I hand over to you, Lisa. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stefan. Chelsea?
Sure. Thank you, Stefan. Lots of good points to pick up on there. If you'll go to the earlier slide, Christelle, I think was in the earlier section, the one with the picture of the floods. That would be great. So, as Stefan mentioned, many of the challenges are shared across the rubber and the cotton sector in terms of impacts on smallholder farmers. This is a picture from 2022, when there were catastrophic floods in Pakistan that hit mid-season, and it affected 1.5 million farmers in Pakistan. It wiped out entire smallholding land areas, which is not only farmers' homes and all of their worldly goods and items, but also, of course, the means by which they support their family. All of that is tied to the same piece of land. And not only did it destroy 40% of that annual cotton crop lost. On average, some farmers lost their entire crop, depending where they were, but also residual impacts, salinity issues, soil degradation issues, organic matter being washed out of the soil affected subsequent seasons of production. And these are not farmers who have robust crop insurance, right, in place and can simply make up the difference easily. So one of Christelle's question was, why are multi-stakeholder collaborations and coalitions important to support smallholder farmers? And really, one of the key reasons is that they help us address the root causes of a lot of the unsustainable or unproductive practices that happen in the field. So you can write into a sustainability standard like our Better Cotton Standard, right, that farmers need to phase out highly hazardous pesticides, or they need to address child labor issues and make sure that children stay in school. And the market can say, you know, that's the cotton that we want to buy, right? It needs to meet this standard. But farmers are not using highly hazardous pesticides because they want to poison themselves and their local environments, and they're not pulling their children out of school because they want to do that, right? Farmers are intelligent, they're smart, they're family oriented. They're doing it because they need to, right? Or because they lack access to better information about alternatives, or as Stefan pointed out, they lack access to just enough finance to be able to invest one step up in better equipment, better processes, better futures for their families. So working together with local NGOs, working together with local governments to make sure that some of these kind of supporting factors and root causes are part of that bigger picture, that we're not just putting sort of top level solutions on or patch fixes on these issues, is really important to drive long-term change. And making sure that there are also good tools for the market and for the buyers and for donors and government programs to funnel investment back in to make sure that the sector is profitable enough to keep cotton farmers farming and able to meet their basic needs of day-to-day life is really important, because until they have that basic stability of income, they are not going to be able to invest in more sustainable or more environmentally friendly farming practices. The second point that Stefan also mentioned is about really building up kind of leverage amongst individual smallholder farmers so that they're able to get better access to information. And that allows them to actually compete better at the base of the value chain. So Stefan gave the example of tappers selling on a day-to-day basis because they can't store any product. We saw last year in India, millions of individual smallholder farmers all hanging on to their cotton, waiting for better prices towards the end of the season because the previous season prices had been very high. And in order to do that, they actually store the cotton in the family home, usually in the living room in many regions, to keep it dry and to keep it secure. And in some cases, entire families were affected by pest pressures and developing skin rashes from having the cotton being housed in their home. And they didn't have enough information to know whether prices were going to go up or go down. And they didn't have any collective leverage to be able actually to drive those prices up as a farmer group or as a producer cooperative in many cases. And so there are some simple fixes that can actually help farmers get more for the hard work that they do on a day-to-day basis. And similarly, being able to tap into basic financial institutions, right? Being able to create a bank account, being able to have some savings so that, for example, when government programs open up loans, heavily subsidized loans for farmers to invest in drip irrigation, many farmers still can't tap into that because they lack just the basic ability of finance to be able to do the 10% subsidized cost, for example. So the fact that the government might be subsidizing 90% doesn't mean anything if a farmer can't get to that 10% that's required in order to take advantage of a more efficient irrigation system. And then just a couple of examples, Christelle, if you go back to the slide that I had before of where we've seen very successful multi-stakeholder collaboration in action that I wanted to mention. The first is a farmer producer organization. Previous slide, please. Thank you. There you go. The one on the left is a farmer producer organization that was founded by ACF, one of our program partners who works with us in Gujarat, India. And this is a Somnath cooperative. They were founded in 2013, and they include about 1,800 smallholder farmers across 44 villages. And they work really to promote the interests of their member farmers or stakeholders. They developed a number of new products. They provided marketing for value-add production, groundnut, cotton, wheat, and other value-added products. They developed new cattle feed products that made it more productive, and they also created a structure to be able to make subsidized loans out to families, members, and also families in the communities. And last year in 2022-23, they made a net profit as a farmer producer organization of almost 30,000 euros as a group. And that is a really important way of giving the farmers not only access to more knowledge sharing and information and collective influence at the base of the supply chain, but also the ability to actually raise more revenue and support a better standard of living for them. And that project was coordinated by ACF, which is one of our program partners that runs on the ground implementation of the Better Cotton Standard System. But it also received initial funding through our Growth and Innovation Fund, which is that mechanism I mentioned earlier, funded by actually brands and retailers who are buying better cotton. And that's an example where that volume-based fee that they pay for sourcing is not only going into sort of annual delivery of capacity strengthening, but is actually being used to set up mechanisms like this cooperative that will support those farming families well into the future and create sustaining revenue sources over time in their own right. And then on the right is an example from our Egypt project. So we work with about 4,000 to 6,000 smallholder farmers in Egypt. Egyptian cotton is famously known as one of the best quality cotton varieties in the world. And it's no accident. Actually, the Egyptian government and the Cotton Research Institute put quite a lot of time and effort into seed development and research. And the Egyptian cotton varieties are highly regulated, tightly organized, and very, very carefully managed to keep those varieties pure. And all cotton farmers in Egypt are already organized into cooperatives. So when we work in Egypt, we work a bit differently, and we are really working hand in hand with the Cotton Research Institute, with the local agronomic extension services to make sure that the advice that they're getting on the ground is in line with the requirements in our standard, which are being set by the market for sourcing of sustainable cotton. And in addition, we are also trying to connect the farmer programs with the brands and retailers and the buyers to enable them not only to source more sustainable Egyptian cotton, but also to create opportunities for investment directly into programs and areas that are really tailored to the local context. And that picture on the top right is from a sort of a field visit where brands and retailers were brought to Egypt to understand some of the local context and the challenges in order to set up programs in the future to better create market access and funding. And as Stefan mentioned, we see that one of the big challenges, but also opportunities, is that with a push towards more traceability and transparency, smallholder farmers are potentially at a disadvantage because they can't compete as easily in a world that's requiring more traceability and more data to be generated at the field level. It is infinitely more complicated to organize 5,000 farmers into a farmer group or an organization, collect data on impacts and yield and production, and create that into a traceability structure compared to providing traceability back to a heavily mechanized, 1,000-acre large farm context. And so as the world starts to move towards traceability with all of its advantages, there is a real challenge that smallholder production contexts and areas become further deprioritized in sourcing and actually receive less investment at the time when they need it most. Christelle, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you. I invite participants, thank you, Stefan and Chelsea, for your interventions. I invite participants to ask their questions in the chat box. And maybe while we're waiting for that, I have a question on the basis of all of the comments you've made. Because, I mean, we saw that undoubtedly we finance is at the heart of it. So we can talk about fair cotton and standards and fair rubber, but there's a price to be paid. Stefan, you mentioned the premium that you advise your members to pay for farmers. And Chelsea, you just mentioned also the funds that support sort of the transition into better cotton. What are the sort of the hurdles you face while looking at the multi-stakeholder? For example, you mentioned the Egyptian government being supportive, but is there also scenarios where there's pushbacks from either companies to pay this premium, because it's all about pricing at the end of the day, or also local legislation? Because it's easy to say we want the perfect standards. We, as you were mentioning, it's easy to say this is what the perfect picture looks like. But on the ground, as you were also mentioning, it's much more hard. It's harder to deploy. So, like, sort of, what is the challenges of disseminating really the standards of your respective organizations? Chelsea, do you wanna or Stefan?
I was just thinking, yeah, where to start? I mean, I think those are all challenges, right? It is the pricing is a major challenge, and I think most of the participants here will recognize this as something that we talk about at Better Cotton increasingly openly as a membership organization, because it is difficult, right, to strike a compromise or a balance when you have different actors from the value chain all represented in the room. And while brands and retailers and traders can say, yes, absolutely, right, we do want farmers to earn a better living. Of course, we want them to have better livelihoods and better prices. They are also constrained by their own business requirements, by the needs to deliver profits to shareholders, by the need to stay competitive in a time of, increasing economic challenge for many textile and apparel companies. So obviously, it is a difficult set of conversations, I think. And one of the ways that we've been trying to address it is really by trying to find what is the common ground, right? So everyone in the room together, right, needs to see cotton farming continue to have a future, right? And farmers to continue to be able to make the investments in sustainable farming that are going to produce the kinds of impacts that brands and retailers are increasingly also on the hook to deliver, right, through their scope three emissions, through their sustainability commitments and targets. And if farmers and farming communities aren't making enough living to be able to invest in sustainable practices, then brands are also not going to be able to see those outcomes. And one of the things that we're looking at developing now that we've just launched last year is what we're calling an impact marketplace, which is about allowing smallholder farmers in particular to be able to better measure and report on the sustainability progress they are making for carbon credits, for emissions reductions, and be able to monetize that or tie that into investment in products in the market beyond just brand and retailer finance, and to create additional revenue sources back to farmers. And that will help lift the whole base of the production sector, as well as providing down the road the ability for brands and retailers, for example, to look at their scope three emissions through their investment in better cotton farming systems.
Thanks, Jesse. Can agree. It's cotton and rubber in that respect are quite similar. In terms of, let's say, the support for the smallholders, not even the smallholders, the plantation, it's obviously in the interest of the industry also to have a fair price. I visited in the past 2 years 11 of our supplier groups on plantations as well as smallholders, and there was not even one which said that they would like to expand the rubber production. They are all, because of the low price, in our case, intend to switch to other commodities, which might be oil palm or durian or whatever. So there, we need to consider these developments and find ways to support the farmers. So we have our fair trade premium. There might be other ways. We are not at the stage at the moment, for example, that we can pay the farmers for the ecosystem services provided. Might be in the long term, might need also governmental interventions. But on the other hand, we need also short-term support, and there, to a certain extent, we need the commitment of the companies and in the end of the consumers. We see, when you ask about the commitment of the private sector, we see, of course, a difference when you have products, garment and footwear, for example, where, let's say, the rubber content might be low. There's a higher engagement in providing finances to the farmers, while, for example, the automotive, the tire industry at the moment is hesitating. Even though the premium would be for per car probably only 6 euros, there's an hesitation to provide financial input, and that's a pity. And there is it's an ethical question. It's a question of sustaining the supply chain and so on. So in these discussions, we need to have in the multi-stakeholder initiatives. I know there are antitrust laws and other issues which might prevent you from discussing that, but we need to find ways to do it. Otherwise, we might face quite some challenges in the near future, at least in terms of the rubber sector. I understand cotton is quite similar.
Thank you. We have a couple of questions. The first one from Carol is, do you have a full traceability of the raw material for both rubber and cotton? Based on her understanding, a better cotton has a mass balance approach. And the second question from Chitelle is, given the barriers of smallholder farmers face in terms of collectivization and integration of in markets, how much support is seen and required from cooperatives as well as farmer producer organizations? And what role can financial institutions play in this space if you have any notable examples? I guess again, Chelsea, and maybe then Stefan, if you can respond to both questions, please.
Sure. So on the first one, we have traditionally run a mass balance system for better cotton in the supply chain, which has served us very well over the last decade. It's allowed the market really to source better cotton at very low comparative administration prices and without adding a lot of cost throughout the supply chain. However, last year, after quite a few years of consultation and research and development, we did also launch a traceability solution in November of last year. So that is now up and running. It will run in parallel to the mass balance system, at least for the foreseeable future. Longer term, hard to tell. And right now, we are really in the process of building uptake and appetite for traceable better cotton, and making sure that brands who want to source traceable better cotton have all the tools and the supply chain mobilization to do that. And then, in terms of the second question, it's really context dependent in terms of actually forming farmer cooperatives. And we found that to do this well, it really requires a lot of bottoms up engagement with farmers and with local organizations or NGOs or our program partners who are working on the ground with farmers. And it's a slow process, right? Because farmers, in order to achieve the objectives of a well-functioning cooperative or producer organization, the farmers need to have good buy-in, they need to have good governance, they need to have the right tools and administration. So although there's a lot of support and kind of lessons learned and case study examples and upskilling that can be provided to facilitate that process, I think one thing we've also learned is that it can't be rushed, it can't be forced, and it can't be top down. Because if you set up a cooperative or a producer organization without going through that kind of engagement and consensus building exercise, you could actually do more damage than good. And in terms of the role that financial institutions can play, that's not my area of expertise, but I'm happy to sort of to come back or to connect you with the right people at Better Cotton who are working more directly on that. But certainly there are some good examples there where through the cooperative structure, we've also been able to open up channels for finance for farmers. Stefan, I'll turn over to you. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Charles. Unfortunately, I can't answer the third question as well. We have not much experience in involving, let's say, financial sector at the moment. Probably because our groups are still quite small, and we try to avoid, bringing in at the moment also public money to as for the one of the reasons which Chelsea mentioned. It's a requirement of the Fair Harbor Standard is that when you're smallholders, that you set up a cooperative, or if you work on the plantation, you have a joint body. But these groups really need to be formed, and it needs a lot of training and capacity building. for them to get to know this type of cooperatives, and that includes also financial management. So at the moment, we prefer rather to start at a manageable, a low level, but definitely there might be room for external financial support, either from the private sector or governmental, which, as Jesse mentioned, needs to be considered in a context base. And about the mass balance system, indeed, we also have a mass balance system at Fair Rubber. Rubber is, there's not much difference in, let's say, like coffee or so, in quality and taste and so on. In the end, it's rubber. But we are looking into the traceability issue, of course, and to a certain extent, some of our members are doing that as well now, because in particular with the European legislation on the deforestation-free supply chain, you have to go more or less into segregation. So that's something that needs to be considered. But on the other hand, we really like to keep the entire system as efficient and low administrative cost as possible, so that this, in our case, this 50 cent euros which we charge as a premium goes to 100% without any deduction to the smallholders. And so that's, let's say, the core and the heart of the Fair Rubber system, that we come from the fair trade system 10 years ago. And so we have always to find the balance between more and additional costs for traceability, for administration. On the other hand, to be able to transfer as much money to the smallholders, those in need, as possible.
Thank you very much. And I guess to build from our experience at XAPA, to build on both your comments. So at XAPA, we engage with smallholder farmers via an app. So it's a low-tech app. And from our experience, as you mentioned, engagement takes time, and we've seen that as well. It takes time. It also, the element of trust is very important. So it's important also to emphasize the importance of the bottom-up approach, as you were saying, Chelsea, the importance of communicating in the local language, the importance of maintaining this capacity building throughout the whole year, really, because it's important not to say, oh, we came in for a training and then we just disappeared for the rest of the year. It's important to keep this trust ongoing through local partners as well, as you were mentioning. But yeah, it's important to mention that. I guess to end on a final question from the participants, in addressing the evident market volatility of cotton, what strategies do you envisage for uniting stakeholders to guarantee economic viability for smallholder farmers?
Sure. I mean, I guess so. This looks like a range of different techniques rather than one kind of silver bullet. So some of it is around diversification of incomes, and we are in our new standard that launches this year. We actually have a new principal area which is covering livelihood support, and part of that is about looking at other ways to diversify income streams so that it's not all one crop, and in fact, it may not be all cropping. And the second is really, as I was mentioning earlier, about making sure that farmers that are making sustainability improvements and are measuring these are being able to access then market demand for impact, really, and being able to tap into markets that are emerging or existing for carbon credits, for payment for ecosystem services. So things that are already existing more for large farms. We're trying to create the kind of scale to be able to allow smallholder farmers to also measure and record and participate in benefits for the improvements that they're making, which ultimately, right, are rewarding that entire value chain as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chelsea. Thank you, Stefan, for taking the time to share your insights with us. Thank you for the participants for taking the time to join. The session will be published later this week on online, and so feel free to share it. And thank you all, and have a nice day. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.